Today is August the 8th, 2018. This is our anniversary show. After a completion of 35 years, bringing you what's new in personal computing. Our first broadcast was August the 4th, 1983. We thank you, the listeners, who have supported this program. Do you know who has your personal data? Let me ask the question differently. Do you know who's using your personal data? Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Podcasting of the program is available on wbai.org/archive, prn.fm, and on our website, pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM 99.5 on the radio in New York and prn.fm on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program except when WBAI is in a membership drive. The programs are different. WBAI in its fifth week of fundraising and we are on live tonight with a different program. Hey, boy, it is some hot day today, Joe.
Hot? I don't feel hot. I'm in an air-conditioned room. The windows are closed. The shade is down, so no sun comes in. I don't feel hot.
Well, listen, you know, we have some news items that will cause many of the executives in the tech area put them in the hot seat, okay? One thing I just want everyone to, it's been reported in the news, but I know you have some strong comments on it, is Facebook. They want to partner with the banks because they feel that they want to give you a better experience by getting information on the transactions you have on the bank, what accounts you have. What is this? They want to, they've contacted hospitals too. Do they want to be the central bank storage area of your life?
No, what they want to be is the central advertising area of your life. What they want to do, they make their profit by selling you your eyeballs. The more information they have about you, the more people they can convince to advertise on their network. If they know, for example, that you have diabetes A, they know, well, diabetes 2 drugs aren't going to work. They can go to Pfizer and say, we have a very narrow list of people who specifically need your diabetes A medicine. I don't know why you would have any problem with that, because they also want to know how much money you spend and what you spend it on, who you spend it with. They want to know about your family life, whether or not you need privacy in your bedroom. They don't care. They want to know what you do in your bedroom. Anybody, in my humble opinion, I'm not speaking on behalf of you, Hank, or anybody else, but anybody, in my opinion, who uses Facebook and expects to have any modicum of privacy, any modicum of ownership of their own lives, they're crazy. They're selling themselves to Facebook. Why should they complain?
Well, you know, Joe, you recently canceled your Facebook account. You should let the listeners know what you had to go through and what happened afterwards.
I wanted to cancel my Facebook account. You can't just cancel a Facebook account. You have to go to Facebook and you have to request canceling it. If you want to download the data that you have on Facebook, you have to request the download. Some of it you can download automatically. Some of it they have to send to you. They haven't sent it to me yet. If in the meantime you go back to your Facebook account to activate it and see whether or not they really canceled it, that will automatically reactivate the account. If it has not been canceled, then you have to go through the whole thing again. Well, I did that, and I reactivated after searching for it and finding I was not canceled yet. I reactivated it, and supposedly now I was fully canceled. A couple of days ago, I went on to Amazon to buy a piece of hardware that I wanted. I found it at several different places, but I didn't make a purchase. I didn't decide on what I wanted. The next time Joanna, my wife, went on to her Facebook account, she started getting advertising for the product that I was looking for on Amazon. Hank, if you're into the internet for anything other than confidential, coded email, whatever you do is public knowledge. If somebody is clever enough to get it, if they really want it, there is no such thing as using the internet privately. A couple of years ago, we had a director of the FBI, Louis Free, who said, when he was asked about the internet, he said, oh, he doesn't use it, so he doesn't know. Why doesn't he use it? He said, there's no privacy. If I do a bank transaction, 47 people who I don't know me by then. It started off with a wonderful idea, the trading of information. But the more it became commercialized, the more that trading of information was the trading of your personal information.
Well, Joe, let me just say that the Wall Street Journal had reported that Facebook pitched the whole idea to J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, Citibank, and U.S. Bank Corp. And guess what? Two of those four banks are partnering with Facebook. Who do you think they
are? How much you want to bet? I don't know anything about the story, but how much you want to bet Wells Fargo is one of the ones?
Yeah, Wells Fargo is one of the other ones.
Wells Fargo has no idea of what privacy for a customer means.
Well,
no idea at all.
They've been fined $1 billion, and now they've been fined $2 billion, and they just shrug it off, and it's part of doing business. By the way, the other bank is Citigroup that will be partnering with Facebook. So I'm not saying that you should cancel your account with these banks, but be forewarned that, hey, they're partnering with Facebook, and you have no idea what this agreement is and what they're going to do with your data. As what I've always said when we start off the show, do you know where your data is? But more important is, do you know what they're doing with it?
The other thing I want to point out is if you look at the terms of usage at Facebook, and I don't want to make them the only people that I don't like, almost all the other so-called social media that does not charge you an account fee, they're doing the same thing. It's just that they're not as big, so you don't know as much about it. But if you look at their terms of service, they are not breaking any rules. They're telling you that in order to enhance your experience online, they are providing services to their partner companies.
Yep.
That means that whatever you have told them, you're publishing to the world.
You know, Joe, this is related to another company that you probably know who it is. Their operating motto is code of conduct. Don't do evil. And the origin of that was because they want to be, you know, they just want to let everyone know that they're not an evil company, and they have to, everything they do, if it's anything to do with evil, they want nothing to do with it. And who am I referring to? Google. And of course...
And that philosophy was set in writing at Google by one of the founding partners.
Yep. It's a code of conduct for all employees at Google. So why don't you tell the people what happened in the last 2-3 months?
Well, first of all, let me point out that that code of conduct was so important to the founding partner, and I can't remember whether it was Sergey or the other one, it was one of the two founding partners, that line, do not do evil, was the first line in their code of conduct. It is now the very last line of a multi-page code of conduct. You have to really be hunting for it in order to find it, because they recognize that they are doing evil. They recognize that it's easier to make money if you do evil than if you don't do evil. Again, I forget who it was that I'm quoting, and I hope I'm not misquoting them, that if you don't pay for the product, you are the product.
Oh, that is Google and Facebook.
That's who it is, but I don't remember who originally said that. And it's true. I don't worry about some of the things I do on the internet if I'm paying for it in one way or another. I do a minimal amount of banking, but I do a fair amount of shopping.
What happened about 10 years ago was that Google was operating in China, and the Chinese government says, hey, we want to be able to censor certain material. And Google says, no way, okay? This is not our mode of operation. And they pulled out of China, I think it was at 2010 or somewhere around then. And now they have an agreement with China. And their agreement with China is they're going to come up with a different search engine. And this was not even brought to the attention of the employees. And the operation of the search engine is by Chinese employees reporting to the Chinese government. Now, that's not doing evil because they're not doing it. It's somebody else is doing it for the government, right? Of course, they get the profits from it, right?
Well, it's more than that. It reminds me back of the days of the war in Vietnam, and Dow Corning, the American chemical company, was making napalm and
Agent Orange.
Agent Orange and all sorts of poisonous things that were basically illegal according to the various so-called laws of war. But they weren't using it. The U.S. government was using it, so it's okay. Well, I don't know about you, but I and all of my friends stopped buying Saran Wrap. That was the only thing we knew that Dow Corning made. It's a very sad thing that time when the people who run totalitarian governments can get away with murder, literally, I'm not talking figuratively, they can kill people, their own people, and we here in this country as a government might object to it, but as people, as private people, as capitalists, we're only interested in money. We don't care how many people get murdered, sent to jail, get tortured. It just makes me absolutely sick. I can't even talk about it on the air, Hank.
Well, let me ask a simple question. What can be done about it because it's a private company?
I'll tell you what I can do about it.
Well,
I can find another search engine, and I can not use Google.
But
I can
are you?
Find another way of... I can find another way of communicating with my friends and not use Facebook. I personally, as a single individual, can boycott whomever I want to boycott. It's within my right. If you don't do it, I can't do anything about it, but I could stop talking to you. I could try to isolate you.
Well,
I can isolate myself.
Well, let me put it this way. Have you actually started using a different search engine other than Google?
I've started using three or four.
Oh, what are they?
Before I talk about them, I'm doing certain tests with them to see how much censorship I don't trust them because I haven't used them yet. But now I don't trust Google, so I'm testing. And within the next month or so, I'll be happy to do a section on the air about what search engine I've switched over to, because I do not want to, what's the phrase, bite off your nose to spite your face? I don't want to do that.
Well, I think the term is throw out the baby with the bathwater, right?
Well, that sort of, I would never want to do that. But I am checking. There are a number of rather strange search engines out there. It used to be very simple. I had a choice of three. Google was the latest, Johnny Come Lately, and then they soon became the top one. And I'm sure they're still the top one, but if the other ones suit my needs, I'll go over to them.
Okay, Joe, there is another item with big tech. You know, there's Facebook, there's Google, but there's now also Apple. And as you know, there's a tariff war between the United States and China. And China is, they have a daily called China People's Daily. And it's a newspaper. And I really got to believe that what they say, they really represent a view of the government although you may disagree with me on that. And they came out very strongly, and the government is basically saying the same thing, is that, hey, Apple, we're going to use you as a bargaining chip. Guess what? You know, we manufacture stuff for you. Everything that you sell comes out of China. Everything you make comes from China. Hey, we'd like you to share in the profits that you have. What do you think of that, Joe?
I think it makes perfect sense. China makes no... As a matter of fact, China very proudly says they're the largest communist nation on earth, and they are. And Apple claims to be the largest, at least from market value, the largest capitalist company on earth, and they are. What makes Apple think that they should not be forced to be in the same political face as the rest of the Chinese government and country? China's a communist nation. Apple, be prepared to be communist.
Well, I think there's an old saying. It's, you know, if you're in bed with the devil, you better beware that, you know, he's got you under control. Hey, Joe,
one way of looking at it. Staying with your analogy, I think if you're in bed with bed bugs, get ready to be bitten.
Hey, you know, Marty Winston is doing he will have later on the air a feature on batteries. You had a preview of it. Do you have any comments on it?
I do indeed. I want everybody out there to listen very carefully and not do what Marty's talking about, because I did it 3-4 years ago. I'm still doing it. I opened up my Nikon camera the other day. I had, you know, nowadays film cameras are sort of like antiques, and I hadn't looked at it for a long time, so I just for the hell of it, I opened it up. I was wondering whether I had left any film in it 10 years ago. I hadn't left any film in it, but I had left some batteries in it. The batteries exploded. I no longer have a Nikon camera. It would probably cost more to fix the camera than it cost to buy in the first place. Marty found the same thing at his home, but not as... I had a very expensive lesson.
Well, what do you recommend then?
Well, first of all, I do not recommend Marty's solution. It was totally beyond me. I know I am not a hardware person. I'm not a hacker like you and Marty are. What he's talking about, I could look at and say, but I could never replicate. Instead, what I'm going to suggest is you check everything in your house that has ever had a battery. Remember when you went into the service station a few years ago and they gave you a flashlight and you threw it into your glove compartment? Take a look at it. That battery could have exploded. Remember, who was it? I think it was Rayovac, but it might have been Duracell. Their big advertising point was our batteries don't explode. But I don't think they were planning on you keeping them for a decade or more. Check and look over there, Hank, behind the kitchen drawer in the back there. Isn't that a timer that runs on a battery? I'll bet that one's ready to explode. The other thing that you can do is you can keep spare batteries around. Now, they all have a timer, a date on them. Keep an eye on those dates. Maybe make a list of the dates. So you replace those batteries, whether or not you've used them, you replace them before the date runs out. Once that date runs out, these lithium batteries can blow.
Well, I was recently on a business trip, and I had to, of course, fly out there. And, you know, the instructions given by TSA is anything with a lithium battery, put it onto a separate bin. In other words, they want your phone in a separate bin. You have a camera, they just assume it's a lithium battery, put in a separate bin.
Well, wait a minute. What do you mean a separate bin?
In other words, where you put your shoes and your belt and everything else one.
Not on the plane when you're getting online to go through inspection.
Oh, getting online. And they're very strict about it. Well, actually, I should say that some of the airlines are very strict about it, and I think that's good. But I don't want to mention the airline, but there are some airlines where they look at you and they say, okay, just go right through. That's pretty dangerous.
But, All right, so take, you're on an airline, and you've taken your shoes off, you've taken your keys out of your pocket, you put them into a bin, you took your battery run wristwatch and your cell phone and your camera, and you put that into another bin.
And your laptop and your tablet.
Do they give those back to you?
Oh, yes. It goes through a machine, okay?
So what good does it do?
They just want to make sure. I don't know. The answer is I don't know.
What do you mean? Make sure what? Make sure that the batteries are not going to explode in the air?
That's a good question.
That will give them as much knowledge about the battery. I'll tell you what they are looking for.
Yes.
They're looking for things that are not battery controlled, but are looking like it, so they can sneak a bomb on board or a gas on board or something like that. Because all they're looking for in the laptop, I know for a fact, is that it is a laptop. In the early days, they used to turn it on. Now they just use the fluoroscopy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And for all I know, you brought up a good point. They look at the battery. What are they going to do with it? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Oh, by the way, Joe, one of the things I learned about flying is that you never argue with them, okay? Because I got up there, I had my shoes on, and say, hey, take your shoes off. I says, well, don't you have a rule on that? And he says, I don't care what the rule is, because I was referring to the rule that if you're over 75, you don't have to take off your shoes. He says,
right.
Take off your shoes. I'm not going to argue. I took off my shoes. That was it, you know? I guess that's one thing that we have to learn is that they may be wrong, they may be right, but if you argue with them, you're going to miss your plane.
I got to tell you, maybe I shouldn't say it on the air.
Oh, go
ahead. I'll tell you a way that unintentionally I legally went through all of the inspection lanes without being inspected.
Legally?
Legally.
Well, I've gotten on planes where there's absolutely no inspection at all, and that's with private planes. Okay, you go on a corporate jet.
No, I'm talking about
commercial airline.
Commercial airline.
Mm-hmm.
Commercial airline. Two of them, American Airlines and the old United.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, I was not in the best of health a while back. I couldn't really walk too well, so the airline provided me with a wheelchair and somebody to push the wheelchair, and they pushed me right through everything. I did go through where they take a picture of the with a metal detector. That's what it was.
Mm-hmm.
I did go through that, but I did it in the chair. So it detected the chair, and then they came over and they used one of those wands on my pocket, but I couldn't stand up, and then I went through everything else. They didn't look in my bag. They didn't look in anything. It was perfectly legal because, in essence, the guy pushing the chair was vouching for me. He was an employee. Now that I've said it, every terrorist out there is now going to go in a wheelchair, and I feel terrible.
Hey, Joe, you know, you and I have been partners on doing the personal computer show now. We just completed 35 years of it, and you had some comments about what you like to be doing with the show, or, well, you know, one of the popular things with the show. Go ahead.
When we started the show, we were in the WBAI studios at 505 8th Avenue. And they were, I wouldn't say primitive, but they were basic, very basic studios. And the first, I don't know, couple of weeks, maybe even a couple of months. Well, at first we were only on once a month, or then once every other week.
No, we were always on once a week, okay? We had and they expanded to 1 hour.
Okay. So things were in flux in the very early days. But after a while, we settled down, and we decided the format would be a call-in radio show with a half hour or so of editorial content like we had. And then in the second half hour, we would start people being able to call in on the telephones, on the air. And we had very religiously stuck to a seven-second delay just in case somebody by accident used a curse word or something. We had a variety of different engineers. And then after a while, we got an engineer named Ross Greenberg who was part of the show with us, and we had talk. But the big part of the show that most of the audience liked was the call-in. And we got a number of awards from the Computer Press Association for the best talk radio show, for the best coverage of computer news. We got two or three of those.
Joe, let me interrupt by saying that, you know, times have changed. People are now more into downloading, podcasting, and so on. I happen to agree with you that a lot of people are asking me, when are we going back to that format? We're on PRN and the capabilities there, and maybe we should rethink our format and perhaps get it going again.
Well, the problem is at PRN.FM, the biggest problem is that they're not prepared to do live radio in the evenings. 9 to 5, they're perfectly ready for it, but in the evenings they're more prepared to carry podcasts or pre-recorded shows. We have been told point blank that when we were up at CCNY, we had telephones. When we were at Wall Street, we had telephones, and we were told point blank that this move to Brooklyn, temporarily, we would not have telephones. We did not change the format of the show. We just eliminated the second half, which was supposed to be call-in radio.
Well, there's one telephone there, and it's been like that for years now. And promises and until they're met are just promises. But hopefully we'll get back to that. Joe, I'm going to...
I don't promise anybody we'd get back to that, but Hank, when we go into these fundraising membership drive things, let's remind the audience that if they support us, maybe...
We'll get it going again. Okay, Joe, you know what? We have a, you know, since we've been finishing up the 35th year, we have a couple of interesting comments from our colleagues who've been doing feature segments for us, and that's Dr. Alfred Poor and Marty Winston. So let's get to it. Before we get to the headline news items this past week, as well as a feature segment, a couple words from Dr. Alfred Poor and Marty Winston with some anniversary messages.
Hey, Hank and Joe. This is Alfred Poor calling to wish you guys congratulations on the 35th anniversary for the Personal Computer Show. Wow, it's amazing all the news and advice and helpful troubleshooting that you guys have offered over the years, along with fascinating stories and all kinds of insights and inside views of what's going on in the industry. Anyway, it's a commendable accomplishment. I feel lucky that I've been a part of it. I actually showed up about 6 years after that you started and have managed to hang around off and on ever since. And I'm proud to be a part of this great experiment. And I hope it continues as long as you want it to go. It's a wonderful benefit to the listening audience. And now that you've expanded on the internet and made it available through other channels, hopefully we can reach even a bigger audience and do even more good for everybody. So again, congratulations on 35 years and on the start of the 36th year. And I look forward to more great stuff from the Personal Computer Show in the years to come. Congratulations.
Hurrah! First, let me start with my congratulations to Hank Key and Joe King on the 3-dozenth birthday of the Personal Computer Radio Show. You know, my wife says they have to be kidding. I say Joe King, and she hears joking. I say Hank Key, and she hears Hanky. But when I tell her that these guys have been talking about computers since the days of the IBM PC and before the XT, just after the TRS-80 debut and Apple was brand spanking new, it really gets you wondering, what the heck is so flawed in computers that they've needed this kind of attention for almost four decades? Can you think of anything else in computing that lasted as long as this show? Not CPM, not data cassettes, not Hayes modems, not computer land stores, not the Appaloosa, not Daisy Wheel printers, not the Comdex trade show. But Joe and Hank and the PC radio show are still running as if being this kind of radioactive will never reach its half-life. Saludos, mi amigos. Salud, mes amis. Prost, meinen Freunden. Cheers, my friends. If this show only lasts until computers stop having problems, you'll be on the air forever.
Thank you, Alfred, and thank you, Marty, for the kind words. NASA's Mars Curiosity rover just celebrated its 6th birthday, but it didn't sing itself a happy birthday. NASA's Mars Curiosity rover has been delivering all kinds of fantastic data and observations from the Martian surface since it landed back in 2012, and it's one of NASA's most prized pieces of space hardware. The plucky rover just celebrated its 6th birthday, which is a big milestone, but this year's celebration was a bit less festive than it has been some past years. One of the internet's favorite science factoids is that Curiosity sings itself happy birthday every year around this time. It's a cute bit of trivia that you find in email chains and Facebook feeds from time to time, and it's partly true, but this year the rover celebrated in silence. To address the obvious question, yes, the Curiosity rover is capable of singing itself a song. It doesn't have built-in speakers to blast a tune across the Martian landscape, but does have a tool that it uses to vibrate soil samples. By programming the vibration to the tune of Happy Birthday, the rover essentially sang itself the tune in a very rudimentary manner. However, that was more like one-time treat from the Curiosity science team than a planned annual event, and it hasn't been done since. The reason is pretty obvious. Curiosity runs on finite power supply from a nuclear battery. Even though the vibrations don't take up all that much power, and it just doesn't make sense for the rover to keep singing every year. Pretty neat and incredibly cute, but certainly not beneficial in the overall scope of Curiosity's mission. So, in 2018, it will come and go without a song from the rover. But that saved power will inevitably be spent on some other more important tasks, and that's fine with us. By the way, you can build your own NASA space rover. JPL has supplied the blueprints and identified all the parts that you need. The NASA rover is an open source design, and you can grab the parts for it and lash them together. NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab has been quietly working on a way to let students and interested hobbyists build a planet exploring rover that's a scaled down version of the American Agency's six-wheel droid. The unit is 1/6 scale, and its open source rover uses mostly off-the-shelf parts, albeit rather a lot of them, since NASA's estimate for the bill of materials is about $2,500. NASA notes that the builders have some wriggle room in sticking to the design. For example, higher speed motors will allow the rover to move faster, although the lower stall torque would limit its climbing ability. Enthusiasts will recognize the suspension system, which keeps all of Curiosity's rover's six wheels in continuous contact with the ground when it's navigating obstacles. The differential pivot offloads weight from one side to the other during climbs, and its six-wheel Ackerman steering governs each wheel direction and speed. There's a Raspberry Pi in there. The Raspberry Pi control system means the rover can be controlled with familiar devices, game controllers, Android apps, and your do-it-yourself coding. JPL is the project sponsor. They explain that the design has headroom in both computation and power system, so builders can add their own source to the rover.
USB cameras and solar panels, for example, for science payloads. JPL said that they released this rover as a base model, and they hope to see the community contribute improvements and additions, and they're really excited to see what the community will add to it. Most of the tools needed for the build are common enough: soldering kit, various wrenches and keys, and while a drill press, bandsaw, and Dremel are recommended, hand saws and drills are feasible for those with steady hands. Let's hear it for all the do-it-yourself, and let's see what kind of designs they come up with. Last week, I talked about Mozilla's Firefox and Google's Chrome were working on to reduce the amount of memory and other resources that their browsers use. Most people are not aware of that as much memory as you think you have, the browsers, while it's active, they grow in size with all the tabs that you open. And when these tabs are active, which is what they are now, it just grabs all the memory there is. And the reason I bring this up is because many of these systems now, sold at the low end, are being equipped with 32 gigabytes of flash memory. Well, that may sound like a lot, but it really isn't. Some systems now are being offered with 64 gig of memory. You must remember that the flash storage of 64 gigs has to include the operating system to run. Well, at 32 gigs, I have such a system, and the amount of storage left over after the operating system, that's Windows 10 that has been installed, there's at most, with a lot of finagling, 10 gigabytes that's left over. However, whenever Microsoft comes up with a big update, and they are all big because they are no longer little pieces of update, they are just one big update for that period. And I have found that after one update, you could easily only have 5 or 6 gig of storage left. So if you're looking at these small systems, bypass the 32 gig, because there are some systems currently being offered with 32 gig of flash storage. Get at least 64 gig and preferably at least 128 gig of flash storage memory. By the way, they call this flash storage memory flash storage SSD hard disk. No, it's not hard disk. It is memory. Memory storage. Period.
This is about all the batteries my cybernetic house isn't using, because instead, we're providing buses that carry the DC voltages that the house needs. I had this grand plan to generate power to the DC buses using a computer power supply, that block inside a system unit, the PSU, plugging that into a UPS. Then something happened to show me the vulnerability in that approach. I just had two of my office's backup power systems fail within a few minutes of each other. I suspect it was their batteries, but I haven't looked into that yet. Instead, it made me think that I was leaving the cybernetic house open to failure points I hadn't anticipated, not to mention gaps in monitoring it. Sorry for all the geek speak. I'll break this up for you so the story doesn't sound quite so much like a science fiction tech jargon plot rationalization. So let me start by talking about the whole idea of making batteries go away. Then I'll talk a little bit about figuring out how many DC voltages we need to feed into how many places and how much of those we'll need. You just heard my original approach to doing that. I'll explain what I was missing with that. And now that I've rethought it all, I'll tell you how I decided to reorganize my approach to DC power and even go into, well, a little of what it takes to deploy that. Along the way, I'll also talk about giving the cybernetics a better way to be monitoring the status of all that, and then about what happens if, despite everything, power goes away anyway. Now, hang on a minute in case you think this is all a geek's pie in the sky and has nothing to do with your needs in real life. Well, I'd like to issue a little challenge. The reason I think it's really important to never use batteries to power fixed position electronics is because people are terrible at babysitting batteries. So here's the challenge. Next weekend, go through your home and hunt for dead batteries, or worse, batteries that already died and leaked and ruined something important to you. Check through all of those drawers, all of those cabinets for every flashlight, every unused remote control, every piece of portable electronics, and for every battery-powered doorbell, every home automation gizmo, every old toy, everything, the works. Every time you find one, put a buck in a basket. When you've gone through absolutely everything, donate those dollars to your favorite charity. Hey, I'm no better. It happens to me, too. And really, why should it happen to any of us? I was very early, before the category really took off, into reviewing scores of home automation products. They ate up AA cells, AAA cells, coin cells, 4A cells, N cells, CR123 lithium batteries, and more. Those were the wall measles, the little white bumps you were supposed to stick everywhere. I'm not really counting the wall warts, those little lumps that plug into outlets, as if you'll never run out of outlets. Anyway, the power supplies in wall warts are not the world's most reliable either. I wanted a better solution, so I started to think about all the PCs I ever built. Every one of them had a PSU, a power supply unit, that metal block with a fan and lots of wires that could deliver nicely regulated 3.3 volt, 5 volt, and 12 volt DC power at substantial currents. I know which pins to connect to keep it powered on, so I thought, hey, plugging one of these into a line interactive UPS at each of six positions would be a way to feed these voltages along a 14-4 cable run. With a backup generator on the power line, the UPS wouldn't need to be running for more than a few minutes at a time, if ever. Well, it was a great theory, but it turned into trash when those two office UPS systems both decided to die. And anyway, that approach was dealing with more power than my systems would really need, even with 100 computers. A little more than half of that 100 live in a central control rack. That rack has a continuous online UPS, but we enhanced that with an Eaton auto failover PDU, that's short for power distribution unit. If that UPS ever fails, the rack automatically switches to line power until the UPS comes back, which could just mean routine maintenance or a battery change or replacing it because it had a complete failure. Also, the two larger computers in that rack both have dual redundant power supplies, so they're nonstop even if a PSU fails. That's the rack. Batteries were never going to be an issue there. It has a few shelves carrying closed frame DC supplies to cover its Raspberry Pi stacks and other needs. Those closed frame supplies look like little metal boxes with perforated skins. The power line comes into one set of terminals and another set provides their rated DC voltage. It can adjust a little bit, and I tend to permanently attach little digital voltmeters to each of these. We know about them because they're how we approach power to the stacks of Raspberry Pi boards in the rack. Away from the rack, the bus wires are how I want to carry DC power to the rest of the computer population and sensor population, and I almost certainly overestimated those needs. Those computers are Raspberry Pi 3 Model B or Model B Plus. They run on 5 volts through a USB connection. The maximum current a B-plus will ever draw is about 2.5 amps, but that only happens when they're asked to do things that I'm not asking them to do. I don't have them delivering HDMI video, I'm not connecting to more than one of their USB ports, I'm not using Wi-Fi, and I'm designing their programming to fit their physical memory so there are no virtual memory swaps going on. I doubt that any one of them will ever draw more than 1 amp. I've been planning 6 runs of DC cabling, meaning I can deploy 8 Raspberry Pi nodes per run. 5-volt, 10-amp, closed-frame power supplies cost less than $15, even less in quantity. So maybe I'll get 20 of those. You'll understand why so many in a minute. I need more than 5-volt supplies. The sensors don't run on 5 volts. They run on 3.3 volts, which is how we power the daughter boards that carry them. The biggest current consumer there is the quartet of IR remote control emitters, but 5 amps is more than enough current for our 3.3 volt needs. I should mention there are a few places where we may occasionally need other voltages, but we can provide those locally without bogging down the bus. The only place we needed 12 volts, for example, was to blink the 3 truck marker lights on the garage ceiling. Bright panel lights could do just as well and run off of the 5 volt bus without straining it. So back to the drawing board. And we don't need those big block computer PSUs to provide our DC power. we can use the reliable little closed-frame DC supplies instead. How much juice will they take? Well, for one of the 5-volt 10-amp supplies and one of the 3.3-volt 5-amp supplies, we're looking at about 75 watts total, well within the range of a cheap under $40 UPS. Here's where we can get a little tricky. When I say a cheap UPS, we're talking about the standby topology, which takes a few milliseconds to switch from line power to battery power. That might normally be disruptive, but hey, you heard me say it, I'll be getting a little tricky. When you unplug one of the little closed frame DC power supplies, its output doesn't immediately disappear. Its capacitors have a little juice left. Whatever's connected to it can still get power for a little while, usually between a fraction of a second and a couple of seconds, but it only takes a smaller fraction of a second for a standby UPS to kick in. Yes, that voltage on its output does fade, so we don't want to depend on it too much, but there's an easy way to back up the backup. We'll get redundant. Add a second little standby UPS with a second 5-volt supply and a second 3.3-volt supply. Well, we'll adjust each for about half a volt more so we can connect those DC supplies to the bus through Schottky diodes. The bus will automatically see whichever voltage is higher at that split second. So there's some ratcheting between the two supply sources, but we've just doubled the available current, even if it's only the current the capacitors can deliver, meaning the voltage will take twice as long to fade. It also means that if one UPS fails, like happened to me, and the other doesn't, well, I'll talk about watching that in a second, but if one UPS fails and the other doesn't, the bus barely sees a dip in the delivered voltage. Double is good. How about more or less triple? The third tier doesn't have a UPS, just the power line going directly into another 3.3-volt supply and another 5-volt supply, again, connecting through diodes. That's our fallback. If both UPSs fail, only an outage will interrupt the power delivery. And, of course, the third set of power supplies now triples the delay before the bus voltage drops too far. Now, how would you want to monitor all of this? In one of my earlier segments, I talked about using opto-isolators to report whether AC power is present or absent in an outlet box. In addition to having one in the outlet box that feeds this little cluster, we can add another one to the AC output of each UPS. If there's power at the plug but not at the UPS, we know that the UPS has one kind of a failure. If there's no power at the plug or at the UPS, we can recognize another kind of failure. We can also design opto-isolators to connect to each of the six power supplies before the diodes to confirm that they're working, and one on each of the buses to confirm that at least one of the three supplies is feeding it. That's 11 separate tests to tell us that either everything is working or something needs attention. For those of you who are into programming, I invite you to think about the 11-bit Boolean this creates. If you can come up with a way to optimize it using fewer readings but can still pinpoint the problems that may need attention, drop Hank a line and he'll forward it to me. Here are those 11 points again. The AC power outlet that feeds it all, the battery-backed AC outlets of each of the two UPSs, the DC outlets of six power supplies, three that deliver 5 volts and three delivering 3.3 volts, and the two DC buses. It's always a mistake to become totally dependent on tech. And all of our measures to keep the tech up and running notwithstanding, it's possible that the power will failure for a long enough period that the UPS batteries will die and for whatever reason, the backup generator might not kick in. What will happen in the house? What if there's a fire? The good news is that we won't be locked in. Our electric door locks need power to be locked. But we don't need power for our dog or my guns. The garage door openers have their own backup batteries. But we can't stay around anyway. The water comes from a well, and without power, there's no water. The phones will still work so we can reach first responders, but the fire sprinklers won't run without power because they need the pump. We could probably get a portable generator to back up the backup generator. Without power, the HVAC system couldn't run, and even with the house having outstanding insulation, it won't stay comfortable forever. Oh, also, the electric lights would have no power, even if the control system could stay alive to command them. I guess the lesson is that Murphy's Law always lurks in the shadows, and about the best you can do is to back up, back up, back up.
Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Tri-State region. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on organizing your media files and how to back them up, Thursday, August the 9th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, room 414 in Manhattan, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group will be meeting Friday, August the 10th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Harry J. Scherr Hall in New York Institute of Technology, located at Old Westbury, New York, on the Old Westbury campus. Brookdale Computer User Group will be meeting Thursday, August the 23rd at 6:45 p.m. at the Middletown Library Lodge Community Room in Middletown Township Public Library at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. Princeton PC User Group will have their general meeting Tuesday, August the 28th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Community room at the Princeton Public Library, located at 65 Witherspoon Street in Princeton, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society has a meeting on Tuesday, September the 4th at 7:30 p.m. that's located at 24 Hospital Avenue in Danbury, Connecticut. The Westchester PC Users Group has a special presentation, Why and How to Easily Create Additional Computers Without Having to Buy Any. Thursday, September the 6th, meeting time is at 7 p.m. The meeting will be held at Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road, first floor in White Plains, New York. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have their meeting on Friday, September the 7th. Meeting time is 8 p.m., and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartow Avenue, Scotch Plains, New Jersey. All these meetings are free and open to the public. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need some technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. Just remember, there is no such thing as a dumb question. And I have the following advice for computer club announcements. All the relevant information should be on the same page, preferably on the home page. And the computer club announcement should have the following: the name of the club, topic of presentation, if any, day of week, and the date of meeting and time, the venue of the meeting, and the location of the venue. Hey, we'll be seeing you at these meetings. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, on the Internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio, or WBAI.org, streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and remember, it's essential you back up. Just remember, three things you have to do: back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy, and until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.